From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. SCTV veteran Andrea Martin has played so many outlandish characters so well that many of her fans think she must be nuts. On today's Fresh Air, the creator of Edith Prickly and Libby Wolfson talks about her real and imaginary lives. Lucinda Williams' new album isn't her first, but it's the first one she's felt totally comfortable with and the first that's getting rave reviews. Coming up, the singer and songwriter talks about finding her real voice fronting a rock band. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from Jackson Brown and Loudon Wainwright, and film critic Stephen Schiff looks at the latest James Bond movie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Police have not ruled out a suicide attempt as a possible explanation for the bizarre crash of a small plane in the Atlantic Ocean yesterday, which the pilot survived after flying unconscious while his plane was on autopilot for 4 hours. Police said today pilot Thomas Root suffered a gunshot wound to the abdomen, which they presume occurred sometime during the flight. Hollywood, Florida, Police Chief Richard Witt says the gun has not yet been found. Root's condition was upgraded to stable following 2 hours of exploratory surgery. He met briefly with his wife and other family members today. Police investigators in Seattle today began to pour through more than 40 boxes of items seized from a man court documents call a viable suspect in the nation's worst unsolved serial murder case. From Seattle, Carol Levinson reports.
The Green River Task Force investigating the murders of more than 40 women between 1982 and 1984 say it will take at least a month to sort through all of the items police confiscated from the Spokane homes of William J. Stevens II this week. While he has not been charged in connection with the murders, the 38-year-old law student came to the attention of the task force through various tips. Task Force Commander Robert Evans says Stevens is being looked at the same way 1,500 other names have been examined, but he also acknowledges there are some, quote, bizarre circumstances in this instance.
There may very well be an innocent answer for all of it. I don't know, but it needs further investigation, and we're going to continue to do that.
Tomorrow is the 7th anniversary of when the first victim's body was found near the Green River in the Seattle area. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
The Defense Department said today it has lifted a temporary ban on new government contracts for Teledyne Electronics Company in connection with the defense procurement scandal. The firm was suspended from government contracting in January after a federal bribery and conspiracy indictment involving the unit and 4 former officials. The firm later pleaded guilty and agreed to pay $4.3 million in fines. A former top official of the Department of Housing and Urban Development today contradicted former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce, who said he had not played a direct role in approving individual housing projects. Former Assistant Secretary Shirley McVeigh Wiseman testified that Pierce instructed her to authorize a $15 million project for Pierce's former law partner. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 16 points to close at 2554.82. Advances led declines. This is NPR News. The Veterans Administration said today it plans to lower the maximum rate it will allow on a 30-year fixed mortgage from 10% to 9.5%. That's effective on Monday. The cut follows a similar half-point drop in the ceiling rate, which took effect June 5th. It reflects mortgage rates that have been declining 1 percentage point since April, after climbing earlier in the year. In Poland, Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa today took the unlikely step of supporting General Wojciech Jaruzelski for president. Both Solidarity and the Communists fear a constitutional crisis may be developing over the presidency. Jane Dobia has the story.
Solidarity and the government agreed earlier this year that the president should come from the Communist coalition. General Jaruzelski seemed to be the only candidate. But then, Solidarity deputies to the National Assembly promised their constituents they would not vote for Jaruzelski, Most polls resent Jaruzelski's decision in 1981 to declare martial law. A survey showed that some Communist coalition deputies also opposed the general. However, Jaruzelski won some support from U.S. President George Bush when he visited Poland this week. Bush called Jaruzelski's government both responsive and responsible. Some say the president's words prompted Lech Wałęsa to back the general, too. Now, the question is whether Wałęsa can convince Solidarity deputies in the National Assembly to follow his lead. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Nearly 900 people have been killed this month in heavy rains, landslides, and floods in China. Xinhua News Agency reported today the rains in Sichuan province have also led to 3,000 injuries. An artillery duel between Syrian and Christian gunners today began when an oil tanker sailed past a Syrian naval blockade and docked at a Christian port. 7 people were killed, at least 12 others were wounded. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andrea Martin, has a talent for becoming other people. For 7 years, she co-starred on the SETV comedy series. She developed the character of Edith Prickly, the station manager of the SETV network. Her other recurring characters included the cleaning lady Perini Scleroso and the self-absorbed talk show host Libby Wolfson. Martin has 3 movies scheduled to come out this year, and you can still see her on SCTV reruns, but she also has a comedy special this month on Showtime, and it co-stars SCTV alums Catherine O'Hara, Martin Short, and Dave Thomas. Andrea Martin plays a screwed-up showbiz version of herself. The premise of the show is that this Andrea Martin has just recovered from a nervous breakdown, and we're watching her comeback performance. The special is called Andrea Martin Together Again. Martin debuts several new characters in the special, but she also brings back the abrasive, cackling Edith Prickly.
The character of Edith Prickly started when I was doing the stage show in Toronto, the Second City stage show. And the Second City, I'm sure people know about this, but I'll just tell you a little bit about it, is based on improvisations. And that night we got a suggestion from the audience to do a scene on a parent-teacher scene. And the parents were called in, parents of uncontrollable, unruly children were called in to talk to the teacher. And I grabbed a costume backstage. I had no idea what kind of character I was going to do. And the costume I grabbed was a leopard jacket and a leopard hat. And it was a costume, actually, that belonged to Catherine O'Hara's mother. And it wasn't a costume of hers, it was actually her wardrobe. And I came on stage in it, had no idea who I was going to do. I think I actually slipped on a pair of black glasses, too. I walked in, and Catherine, who was playing the teacher, said, "And you must be Mrs. Prickly." And I said, "That's right, dear. Edith Prickly. Prickly's a name, parenting's a game. Ha!" I don't know where it came from other than something deep inside of me, and it's something I got to very quickly, and it really stuck from then on.
Gee, when you put on clothes that are somebody else's clothes, will a new personality just come over you?
Yeah, oftentimes it does. I've oftentimes jokingly said that I create a character from the outside in. I don't know if that's the training that I've had, you know, so much improvisational work. But costumes are very important to me, that I get, even in a movie, even in a film, a very straight part, they really have to feel right on me. I can't even wear the perfume that I normally wear as myself. I have to find another kind of perfume so I can really create that person. And it certainly happens in the characters that I do on, you know, the comedy characters too.
When you're working on characters, do you ever go to places just to sit and observe people?
When I was doing SCTV, I really did that. The best places were malls. Malls. Gee, that's a bad word now. I said mall and I felt like a tiger being, I'm sorry. I used to go to shopping centers and malls and sit on the benches there, watch people go by, watch people relate to the salespeople, watch mothers with their kids. It was a real important place for me to be. Then sometimes what I'll do is think of a characteristic of somebody that really I found intriguing and then develop a character around that, you know. Just start with one little thing.
It's my impression that you gravitate to characters of an older generation, people who might have been the parental figures in your life, parents, teachers, parents of friends.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I grew up in a household where parties were the norm. In fact, my first memory of entertaining in front of anybody was at, I'm Armenian, both my parents are Armenian, was at an Armenian dance. There was this tradition that children would get up and dance and the adults would give them dollars. Gee, it doesn't sound good as I'm recalling it. But I remember doing that, getting up and dancing to this Armenian song and not feeling at all inhibited and looking at all the wonderful faces around me and feeling very comfortable in that adult world. So, in fact, I always felt more comfortable in that adult world than I did with peers. You know, growing up in Portland, Maine, an Armenian in a very WASPy community never made me feel completely at ease. So maybe I did gravitate toward the community itself, towards the adults that I so often live with in my home, because my parents were constantly socializing. So that's a pretty good observation.
You have several movies coming up. One of them is called Rude Awakening. And in this one, you play one of these older, prudish, pinched characters that, you know, it reminds me of some of the characters that you've done in sketches, but this is a movie, so
right.
You're in character in a different way than you are in a comedy sketch. And I'd like for you to compare what the difference is when you're acting between doing a character in a movie and doing a character in a comedy sketch.
Well, gee, it's a very fine line, actually. Let me think about this character that I play in this movie, April Stuhl, is in a scene that's actually quite sketchy, I guess. It's a cameo appearance. I play Buck Henry's wife in it. And I think that I think that if I hadn't worked hard enough to ground that character in reality and in the situation that she was in, again, I was surrounded by very real people, Cindy Williams and Robert Carradine and Eric Roberts and Julie Haggerty, I think it would have come across as a sketch. So I think the difference is, in a sketch, it's not a very real world. I guess you assume that it's a whimsical world. It's actually going to exist for like 3 minutes. It's just a shot in the dark there, and it's a fantasy that you create for a few minutes. In a movie, and in a very real part, you have to create a very real world, and it continues for much longer than 3 minutes. So I guess that's the difference there.
Do you think that casting directors see you as an actor in terms of the characters that you've done on SCTV?
You know, I don't know what casting directors think when they see me. I think that they think I'm real funny and oftentimes don't know what to do with me, to tell you the darn truth. I don't know. I certainly have played very real parts in movies, and I guess you didn't see Black Christmas with Olivia Hussey. That couldn't have been more real a part. And Margot Kidder. And in a movie that I'm doing called Worth Winning, I play a very centered, grounded person, a child psychologist, actually. And, you know, it's a bit like 30-something. It's so grounded in yuppiedom reality. I don't know. I wish I knew, to tell you the truth. I wish I knew what went through their minds. I don't know. That's a hard one for me. You know, I get real angry sometimes when I seem not to be auditioning for parts that I think I can play because somebody might think it's too sketchy, too comic. I'm not sure about that one. I don't know how to change that.
SCTV is still in reruns, so in the minds of viewers, it's still a current show. Do you think of that as being good for you or bad for you?
Oh, I think it's attracted a different audience now. And none of my peers watched it because they all had children and went to bed at 11, and it's a late-night show.
Uh-huh.
So now I think because it's on at 10:30, it is in Los Angeles on Nickelodeon. I don't know what it is across the country. It's attracted a different audience. I guess it's gratifying for my ego to think that I'm being watched by people that truly appreciate that kind of comedy. There's a certain point where I get frustrated with holding on to the past and having to recall those years, because that seems to be that show seems to have given me the most notoriety, so people hold on to that thought, and they also like the show. So that's what I find I talk about the most, and I'm proud of it. I think there's a certain point, though, you know, where I feel like I'm Ringo Starr of the Beatles or Paul McCartney of the Beatles, where you just have to sort of let go and continue with your life. So it's a blessing in disguise, really. It'll be nice to be able to do something that has as much
impact.
Yeah. And be able to talk about that for a while and then end it with talking about SCTV.
Can I ask you some SCTV questions now that we've, now that we've gotten into this? My goodness. You're from Maine.
Yeah.
So you were the non-Canadian on SCTV?
Harold Ramis is non-Canadian, and Joe Flaherty is non-Canadian. Harold was brought up from Chicago, and Joe was brought up from Chicago, and I was actually living in Toronto. We all started the theater company there together, and then it evolved into the television show.
Mm-hmm. Did you watch a lot of television as a kid growing up in Maine?
No, I really watched no television as a kid growing up in Maine, which is really ironic that I would be doing 7 years of parodying television. I started in children's theater in Portland, Maine, and then did, you know, about 5 years of summer stock, Kenny Bunkport Playhouse, the Algonquin Playhouse. I played Liat in South Pacific at the age of 13 and got my equity card. Then I majored in drama in Emerson College in Boston, and then went on to New York to do Your Good Man Charlie Brown. And the only television I ever watched was Ernie Kovacs, the Nairobi Trio, and occasionally Ed Sullivan, and a couple of episodes of Lassie, but that's it. So I think what people like about SCTV is a great cross-section and references of comedic sensibility. And so oftentimes the theatrical parodies we did, like Annie or Indira, which was based on Evita, were things that I had were my preference, and that's what I wanted to parody. So it wasn't all just television that we parodied, and if I ever had to do any television parodies, believe me, I spent hours watching the shows in a little room to get a handle on what we were actually parodying. I remember watching one of the guys, I think, gee, who wrote this? What's My Line? We did a parody of What's My Line called What's My Shoe Size? And I played Arlene Francis on it and had never, ever seen What's My Line and spent hours watching the tape of the show so I could get the impersonation of Arlene Francis. So it's kind of weird. That's how my life ended up.
Well, I want to talk with you some more about your characters and about your forthcoming movies. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Andrea Martin, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Andrea Martin. She's a veteran of the SCTV comedy series. This month she has a comedy special on the Showtime cable channel, and she's also opening in several new movies. Since you hadn't watched TV much as a child, when you actually started watching it more studiously as an adult during your SCTV years, do you think the television looked even more absurd to you because you were watching it and parodying it at the same time?
More absurd to me. Boy, I guess I'd never sat back and watched television as a form of entertainment. It was never a relaxing thing all those years. It was always like work when I watched it. So I never felt like I could unwind after a day, you know, and just sit in front of the TV and watch All in the Family or something. I'd think, how would I get that voice down? How would I do that little mannerism? And It was the hardest thing to parody. All those years were sitcoms, you know. They really, I could never get a handle on how to make a parody of them because they all seem so much of a parody themselves. It's kind of weird. When I did my own sitcom, I felt like I was actually living the parody that I'd been doing all those years. It was very bizarre.
So tell me more about how that felt. This was a sitcom that was this kind of a spin-off from Kate and Ally. You played someone who ran a small cable TV station, and that character was spun off into her own series. Do I have that right?
A character called Roxy.
Uh-huh.
That's right. I don't know. It was pretty strange, you know, pretty strange being very sincere about issues that I could have cared less about, like really being intense, coming home to my husband. Honey, you cannot believe what happened at the station today. I just felt like I was doing children's theater, you know. My back was sort of bent forward and my arms were gesturing far too much for any human being. I just couldn't get behind the real world that they were creating for me. It just didn't seem very real, you know. It was hard.
Well, what do you do in a situation like that? Is there any way you can take more control?
I guess you
of
get off the air very quickly. That's what happened to me. I guess you don't have a choice. I guess the networks tell you for you what you do. Thank you very much, and good luck in another form. That particular show was a really real hard one for me. I couldn't find any way to comment on the I felt a real necessity to comment on who the person was, because I just didn't believe that anybody like that really existed, you know. And that's not what they want. They really want you to be that person. So, you know, I'm sure there are other, my gosh, Taxi, those people are very real and have an edge to them that I can really identify with, and Cheers. And there are certainly shows that are exception, but this was not one of them.
Well, it must be a really difficult decision to make when you, if you want to do a TV series and the one that you can do isn't one that feels very real to you. I mean, if you turn it down, you feel like you're passing up a big opportunity, and if you take it, you feel like it's not really you.
Yeah, it's a dilemma. That's where a good agent comes in, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, you grew up in Maine, and I think of you as being very, I don't know if hyper is the right word, but you have all these different characters always coming out of you, and I think of Maine, this is perhaps a stereotype, but I think of the people in Maine as being very, very much more low-key, speaking very slowly, being much more contained. I was wondering if you felt somewhat on a different wavelength from a lot of the people around you when you were growing up.
Well, we were talking about the characters that I play, and I think that a couple of the characters that I do are very slow and contained and provincial. And Yolanda de Vilbis is a very quiet, she's a quiet spoken person without very, she doesn't have very much finesse in entertaining. And those are the kind of people that I remember. A woman like that in church at St. Luke's Church in Portland, Maine, standing up and saying, the flowers this week have been donated by some women in the pew women, and let's thank them very much from us. And so that's a character that came from my days in Maine, being an energetic gal in an Episcopalian church and looking at this woman who was so painfully shy. So I guess I've used them. I guess I've used them all.
Andrew,
I'll be using you.
Andrew Martin is my guest. I have to ask you this, and I'm not really sure how to ask this, but you know, your Showtime special Together Again is a kind of spoof of an entertainer who's had a nervous breakdown and they're back with their comeback special. And so you're watching, you just have to ask yourself, is just a parody of the genre, or has Andrew Martin had a breakdown herself, and is this like her parody of her own comeback? So you'll forgive me for asking, but I just feel like I have to.
I won't forgive you, but I just have to answer the question since this is your show. I have not had a nervous breakdown. But, not but. What the heck? sound like I'm going to be carted away in a minute for that response. I haven't had a nervous breakdown. I haven't had a nervous breakdown. Why am I defensive? I thought what was intriguing about that kind of thing, a girl having a nervous breakdown, was a really, oh gosh, being able to stand outside of anything that I consider far too serious in my life and be able to laugh at them. So I guess in some way it was therapeutic. I don't think I could ever have a nervous breakdown, to tell you the truth, because at a moment when I am the most down, something just, some kind of thing snaps in me and I just look at it and laugh at it and just realize, as Edith Prickly says, never let yourself get down unless you're willing to do something worthwhile once you're down there. I guess it's a little checks and balance thing that I've been born with. I'm really lucky to have. So you can be calm about this, that I wasn't in shock therapy when I was doing this special. I'm not on lithium right now as I talk to you.
You know what it is, that a lot of us, I think, have the stereotype, too, that anyone who has so many personalities that they're capable of doing and so many different tones might be a little imbalanced. You know, how can you possibly keep all of that in balance?
I work out. I eat very well. And I walk every day for 2 miles. It's sort of what you were expecting me to be, the female Jonathan Winters.
That's a scary idea, isn't it?
I don't know. No, I don't think I am that crazy. No, I think I am pretty balanced, to tell you the truth. I mean, I have 2 children. I have lots of friends. I live in the Palisades in California. You know, one part of me is very sane and extremely boring, to tell you the truth. I'm a Capricorn. You know, I'm very pragmatic, practical, obsessively clean. I like things in order. And then there's another side of me that needs to have an outlet for all these characters. But so far, I've kept it pretty well in balance, I think.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you what kinds of roles you'd like to be doing in movies. Like what kind of direction you see your career taking?
You know what? I'd like to play a part in a film that allows me to be a woman that I am, and an attractive, smart, together woman. With an edge, with all the quirkiness that I bring to the characters that I do. Allow me just to be who I am without wearing a leopard jacket and glasses, and just rely on things that are instinctively funny about me. I think it would be a great thing for any casting director to decide to do. That's what I'd like to be doing.
Andrea Martin, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrea Martin's Showtime comedy special, Andrea Martin Together Again, will be shown on July 14th, 19th, 24th, and 30th. She'll also appear in the movie Rude Awakening, which is scheduled to open in August. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be true crime writer Jack Olson. His new book, Doc, tells the story of a doctor in a small town in Wyoming who for 25 years was raping his female patients during exams. Many of the sexually repressed women in this largely Mormon community didn't even realize what was happening to them. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. She writes love songs that are implicitly feminist, and she sings in a voice influenced by country, folk, and the blues. Coming up, we meet Lucinda Williams and listen to her new album. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker compares new albums by two singer-songwriters, Jackson Browne and Loudon Wainwright. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new James Bond movie, License to Kill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The Economic Summit opened in Paris today with remarks by French President François Mitterrand, who talked about inflation and trade protectionism. He referred only briefly to the demand for a so-called North-South summit by some of the leaders of developing nations who are in Paris for the bicentennial of the French Revolution. Those poor countries want an international conference focusing on third-world issues such as poverty and hunger. Two former Housing and Urban Development officials testified on Capitol Hill today. They said that contrary to his sworn statement, former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce did play a direct role in deciding funding for a North Carolina project. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
Former Housing Commissioner Shirley Weissman and Janet Hale testified that Pierce pressured them to fund a project, an old hosiery mill sitting on a toxic waste dump in Durham, North Carolina. Former Durham Mayor Charles Markham, a former law associate of Pierce's, wanted to turn the mill into housing for the elderly. Weissman refused to approve it, even after Pierce personally told her to do so. Pierce approved the project himself. Subcommittee member Christopher Shays called Weissman's testimony devastating.
We have the secretary who made it very clear to us, and he was asked on more than one occasion, did you ever try to influence a decision in your department for a particular project? He said no.
The subcommittee wants to question Pierce again. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
A Delaware judge has temporarily blocked Time Incorporated's $14 billion takeover of Warner Communications. Paramount Communications has filed an appeal with the Delaware Supreme Court. NPR's Barbara Mantell has more on the story.
Paramount quickly filed for an appeal and asked the court to postpone Time's $14 billion purchase of Warner until the appeal is heard. The court agreed to a 10-day postponement. Many on Wall Street predict that eventually Time will succeed in taking over Warner and, in so doing, create one of the most powerful information companies in the world. Time's magazine and book empire, its cable system operation, its cable movie channels HBO and Cinemax, would be joined with Warner's book division, cable system, movie studio, television production company, and record studios. However, it is possible that Paramount might make a bid to take over the combined Time Warner, or it might try to regain the offensive by increasing its bid for Time Inc. alone. I'm Barbara Mantell in New York.
The captain of a Greek tanker who ran aground off Newport, Rhode Island, now faces two state felony charges in addition to his federal pollution charges. State officials have charged the captain with failure to have a harbor pilot on board the vessel at the time of last month's spill and polluting coastal waters. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up today 16.50 points to 2554.83. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Both Jackson Browne and Loudon Wainwright III have new albums out and are touring the country. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Wainwright's material, as always, is quirky and confessional. Browne's, as you can hear on this song, is more political.
Down on Main, there's a family sleeping in the doorway. Around the corner, you can hear the sound. People dancing.
In the mid to late 70s, the term singer-songwriter came into use as a label for folk-influenced pop performers who were writing largely autobiographical material. Singer-songwriters stirred up fierce feelings of both adoration and annoyance. To their fans, performers like Joni Mitchell or James Taylor were describing small personal epiphanies that invited intense audience identification. On the other hand, many rock fans felt that the singer-songwriters were making music that was watered down and egocentric. In the 70s, two of the most autobiographical of them all were Jackson Browne and Loudon Wainwright III. Their careers in some ways stand in opposition to each other. Browne became a big star with albums like Late for the Sky and The Pretender, and then proceeded to turn his back on autobiography, to write political songs like the ones that fill his new album, World in Motion. Loudon Wainwright, after the freak novelty hit Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road in 1972, became an increasingly obscure cult figure who remains intent on describing his own emotional heavy weather in humorous terms.
I wonder why you love me, baby. I hardly love myself at all. I think we're both a little crazy. We need some therapy, that's all. I'll see a man, you see a woman. You need a mom, I need a dad.
That's Loudon Wainwright and the title song from his new album, Therapy. Wainwright's achievement over the years has been to describe the details of an upper-middle-class upbringing and subsequent marriage, fatherhood, and divorce in terms that for the most part deny any trace of self-pity. Sure, he's thoroughly self-absorbed, but Wainwright's saving sarcasm, combined with a poetic gift for impeccable rhyme and meter, prevent his music from seeming self-indulgent.
When you borrow your father's car, doesn't matter how old you are. You don't ever drive too far. When you borrow your father's car. And when you drink at your mother's house, have a couple, but don't get soused. You don't want to play surrogate spouse with her. When you drink at your mother's house, you don't want to make the old man boil. The jalopy needs a treatment royal. Play it safe every time and check the oil. You don't want to make the old man boil.
In contrast to Wainwright, Jackson Browne has chosen to blunt his own subtle songwriting skills in favor of composing harsh, direct attacks on U.S. foreign policy. Browne has in recent years become involved in the Christic Institute's effort to expose a so-called shadow government in this country, conducting illegal covert wars in Central America. It's this sort of concern that is inspiring Browne when he invokes Oliver North and others in a song called The Word Justice. As admirable as I find Jackson Browne's political commitment to be, I do think his music has been weakened by the didacticism on display in a song like The Word Justice. And there are much worse songs than that, a limp reggae tune called When the Stone Begins to Turn that drags Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela into its slack rhythm, and this version of Little Stephen's dreadfully self-righteous song, I Am a Patriot.
And I ain't no communist, and I ain't no capitalist, and I ain't no socialist, and I ain't no imperialist, and I ain't no Democrat, sure ain't no Republican. I only know one party, and it is. And I love my country.
Ultimately, I agree with the novelist Vladimir Nabokov, who said, "Art resides in style and detail. Big ideas result in hokum." There's too much hokum in Jackson Browne's music these days. On the other hand, I think Loudon Wainwright's willingness to portray himself as a jerk, a philandering husband, a well-meaning but oafish father, has its own brave integrity.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I'm full of fear and paranoia. Oh, you are hysterical and sad. Let's do it, babe, you know I love you. It costs so much, it can't be bad.
This is Fresh Air. At 36, singer and songwriter Lucinda Williams is a veteran of coffeehouses and clubs. She even made two folk and blues records on Folkways in 1979 and 1980. But her current record was a personal and critical breakthrough. She says she's finally found the right combination of musical styles. Rolling Stone critic Stephen Pond wrote that the album is a low-key, beguiling affair. Plain-spoken lyrics, straightforward melodies, simple arrangements. Williams has the sense and the skill to make her points in the most direct and least cliched ways possible. I spoke with Lucinda Williams while she was in Philadelphia opening for Loudon Wainwright. Her latest album's called Lucinda Williams, and it opens with her song, I Just Wanted to See You So Bad. I recognized the sentiment of this song, this feeling that, like, you've really got to see someone,
yeah.
And you'll be going out of your way and maybe making a fool out of yourself, too, but
uh-huh.
You're going to do it anyways because you have to. What's the song about to you?
Well, it's based on something that actually happened. I feel a little silly talking about it now, but that's the oldest song on the album that was written about 1980, around that time. And it's just one of these classic stories, I guess, of having met someone and you live in two different towns and he was going to be somewhere near where I was. So called me up and I'm going to be here over the weekend. Let's get together. You know, you've been carrying on this thing over the phone and it's been building up, you know, this whole fantasy thing. And typical, you know, women who love too much syndrome. You know, so I had a gig that I said, yeah, of course I'll be there, you know. And so, you know, I get in my car after the gig, pack a little bag, driving all night, literally, and almost ran out of gas. Really dangerous, really stupid and dangerous.
I think the songs that you write and your singing voice are just so perfectly matched to the kind of very, like, basic rock and roll backing that you have.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the backing just works really perfect for you. Did it take you a long time to figure that out, that
yeah.
was the right thing for you?
Yeah, it did, because I started out in a real traditional format, and I was real leery of even having drums behind me. It made me real uncomfortable, because I was just a folk singer with a guitar for years and years, you know. And I sort of kind of played around with the other musicians a little bit off and on, you know, but it took a lot of trial and error to get the right people, because you have to have a drummer who's real sensitive to the singer-songwriter thing, you know, and he has to lay back when it's time to lay back and that sort of thing, and really leave a lot of space for my vocals.
I want to play another song of yours.
Okay.
I'll play Passionate Kisses.
Is it too much to ask? Oh,
Passionate Kisses has a really catchy melody. I think really, really neat lyrics. You write the lyrics and music yourself. I'd like to know how this song came together. Like, what came to you first in it? What did you build the song around?
Probably just the chorus that, yeah, I usually build it around like a hook line, you know, like passionate kisses. I'll kind of, you know, play around a little bit and kind of a tune will kind of come into my mind. I was sort of thinking of Joan Armatrading when I wrote this song. That was kind of the idea, because it was, you know, that real rhythmic sort of thing that she does, you know,
mm-hmm.
passionate kisses, that kind of sort of, I don't know how to describe it really, but that's what was going through my mind at the time.
I think in your music career, you've been through a lot of different styles,
mm-hmm.
probably a lot of different personas in a way. You've done folk music.
Yeah.
Country music, blues.
Yeah, but never all separate. I always did them all.
Well, your new album's on a small label, Rough Trade, which is a British label.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go with them so that you could have freedom, control in the record?
Yeah, it just sort of happened because, they signed me really with, they'd never seen me perform, just on the strength of my songs and vocals. And the other major labels weren't doing that. I mean, they wanted to see a show more. And see, Rough Trade came along and just, they heard some tapes and they said, we like it, let's do a record. So I didn't have to worry about, do I have the band together? What do I look like on stage? You know, that sort of thing.
I want to talk a little bit about your background. Now, mm-hmm. I know your father is a poet.
Right.
Miller Williams. He's also the editor of the University of Arkansas Press.
Right.
Do you think it affected your sense of language to be growing up with a poet in the house?
Yeah, definitely. I remember him reminding me not to use trite, cliched phrases. Your eyes twinkle like diamonds in the sky or whatever, you know, that sort of thing.
What was his attitude towards song lyrics? Did he like them? Did he think they were trivial?
No. He considered them two different things, though,
mm-hmm.
pretty much poetry and songwriting.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I don't really consider myself, I mean, I've sat down and tried to write poetry, and it just feels real difficult and awkward to me. I don't understand. It has a different pattern completely. And he's tried to write songs and has failed miserably. So. You know.
Let me ask you about another song, Side of the Road.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about writing the song.
That was when, also in the beginning stages of when I was married or right before I got married. And I think, you know, I was just feeling that pull, that feeling of not really being sure, you know, about who you're with, maybe, or, you know, if it's really the right thing, that sort of, that really gut fear thing, you know, am I really doing the right thing? And, you know, when you're in a relationship and you're kind of, well, I should be happy, but for some reason I'm not, and, you know, that, and also, I think I was thinking a lot about how I used to feel before, and I had sort of lost something.
Right, and so to regain it, you wanted to be by yourself.
Yeah, that's basically what it's about.
You wait in the car on the side of the road. Let me go and stand a while. I want to know you're there, but I want to be alone. If only for a minute or two, I want to see what it feels like to be without you. I want to know the touch of my own skin against the sun, against the wind.
Have you ever, consciously asked yourself, how do you write a love song that isn't a victim-type song, you know, that isn't a feminist screed, but on mm-hmm. the other hand, takes into account certain feminist principles that you live your life by.
Right.
It's not easy to do.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to do, though. That's really well put. Because a lot of people, I mean, I haven't heard it described that way, but that's really it, you know. Because I always get asked that a lot, you know, are you a feminist? What are your political views? You know, that sort of thing. And yes, I consider myself a feminist, but it's just more what you said, you know, not being overtly political about it. It's not really political to me. It's more of a humanistic, personal thing.
I've got to ask you about another song. This is called Changed the Locks.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, this song really kind of stands an old cliche on its head, you know, because this song is about, you know, changing the locks on the door so mm-hmm. so that an old boyfriend can't find you, changing the clothes that you wear so that he won't recognize you. But it's really about doing it so that you don't see him, not so that he doesn't see
right.
you. Because you're afraid you're going to want him even more and don't want to want him.
Right. That's exactly right.
I changed the number.
How did this one come to you?
It just in a fit of anger and frustration. It just really popped out. I think I wrote it in about an hour or something. You know, I mean, I got the basic idea for it and the tune and everything really fast. And then, you know, I went back and kind of cleaned it up a little bit.
And the extreme verse at the end, I changed the name of my town.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I really allowed myself to go in that song, you know, and really use more fantasy.
I changed the name of this town so you can't follow me down, and you can't touch me like before, and you can't make me want you more. I changed the name of this town.
Lucinda Williams singing her song Change the Locks from her album Lucinda Williams on the Rough Trade label. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have planned for this Bastille Day?
Well, we're covering the president's trip to the summit in Paris and all sorts of events having to do with the bicentennial of the French Revolution, the parade, the influence of the French on America during that revolutionary period, both theirs and ours, the food people were eating in the Bastille the day that it fell, that sort of thing. So we're going to take a good long look at what's going on in France. We'll be talking to an American boy who is studying with the Bolshoi Ballet, and we're going to take another look at the HUD scandal.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new James Bond movie, License to Kill, just opened. For the second time, Timothy Dalton is playing 007. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
With License to Kill, James Bond says goodbye at last to the spoofy, campy 60s zeitgeist that gave him birth. This movie is entertaining, but not with a wink and a nudge. It's a suspense thriller, a little grim and a little scary. And it's not about gadgets, pop culture, and fun babes painted gold. Oh, the movie has its jokes. It indulges in the usual smirky puns, and Wayne Newton is even on hand as a felonious TV evangelist. But there's a new solemnity in the air. In License to Kill, Bond isn't battling some hilarious feline-stroking villain who's out to control the solar system. His enemy is a drug baron named Sanchez, played with steely grace by Robert Davi. When Sanchez mutilates Bond's CIA pal, Felix Leiter, and kills Leiter's new bride, Bond goes on the warpath. And even Her Majesty's Secret Service isn't willing to back him up.
This private vendetta of yours could easily compromise Her Majesty's government. You have an assignment, and I expect you to carry it out objectively and professionally.
Then you have my resignation, sir.
We're not a country club, 007. Effective immediately. Your license to kill is revoked.
When Ian Fleming first invented Bond, the world still believed in superheroes. But by the time 007 reached the screen in the early 60s, that view was changing. The Bond portrayed by Sean Connery was born not so much into a Fleming world as a sadder but wiser John le Carré world, a post-Kennedy assassination world in which things were seldom what they seemed. Conspiracies lurked everywhere, and men who presented a heroic face might be anything but underneath. Bond could survive in such an atmosphere only with a bit of a smirk, and Connery's Bond grew more and more self-parodic as the series wore on. When it was Roger Moore's turn to don the mantle, the movies became downright spoofy. After all, Moore was soft and pouchy, and his British superciliousness seemed more appropriate in the drawing room than on the fields of action. But in the best of the 70s Bond movies, The Spy Who Loved Me, that was perfectly all right. We weren't able to take Bond seriously again, not yet. License to Kill, though, finds us ready. Perhaps we've discovered we can't quite live with the notion that there are no heroes. But we also don't believe that heroes are born from the head of Zeus. No, this is the summer of Batman, the Dark Knight. We've come to recognize that if you scratch a hero, you may find someone who has suffered, someone whom life has dealt a raw deal, someone whose heroism has emerged from a kind of Nietzschean forge of pain and woe. That's the brand of sorrowing power Timothy Dalton exudes. He's fighting a drug kingpin, a real villain, and his weapons are not just Q's crazy gimmicks, but also a reservoir of psychological understanding that he's come by the hard way. Even in his ludicrous romance with Bond Girl A, badly played by Talisa Soto, and his unexpectedly convincing one with Bond Girl B, quite well played by Kerry Lowell, there's an air of something pained and unyielding in Dalton. He isn't the sexual opportunist of yore. If his portrayal hasn't quite come into focus yet, this is nevertheless the first time in more than a decade that one felt James Bond could be a full-fledged character, not just a walking license to kill.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Gladys Knight sings the title song, License to Kill.
Got a license to kill, and you know I'm going straight for your heart, baby.
Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries on Fresh Air. Our show this week was produced by Fred Landerl, and our senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next time on Fresh Air, writer Jack Olson. He's been called a master of the true crime genre, and in his new book, he tells the story of a Wyoming doctor who systematically raped his women patients. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews more previously unreleased Duke Ellington sessions. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.